From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, can Texas lawmakers rein in sales of THC hemp products like Delta 8 and 9 that are largely unregulated and widely sold, even to children? And in the time of growing drought, Mexico's water debt is becoming a bigger issue along the border.
You know, Mexico can kind of be a political scapegoat for this, but there's also, you know, things that need to be done.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, the Texas Senate Committee on State Affairs held a public hearing to examine products like Delta 8 and Delta 9, which are hemp products that produce an intoxicating high. They're sold legally in Texas, but that could change in the coming legislative session. The U.S. market for Delta 8 THC and other hemp-derived cannabinoids has increased a whopping 1,300% in just the last 3 years. It shot up from $200 million in sales in 2020 to nearly $2.8 billion in 2023. That's according to the analytics firm Brightfield Group. In Texas, where legal cannabis is not available, the hemp-based products of Delta 8 and Delta 9 are. It's a market that's largely unregulated. The gummies, vape, juice, and smokables are sold in specialty shops, corner convenience stores, and even in vending machines.
Due to this, he suffered from cannabis-induced psychosis.
A Texas Senate committee heard the story of Veronica Rios, who said her son is addicted to the THC products.
He's currently taking antipsychotic medication and is struggling every day with his mental health and probably for his rest of his life. Francisco has been at a recovery center and then to a sober living. This costing us thousands of dollars. I ask you, the people in charge, the ones who have the power to really make a change, how would you feel if it happened to one of your family members?
Rios begged the lawmakers to find a way to ban THC.
We can find it everywhere, in every single strip mall, close to schools, and high schools, middle schools.
Susan Hayes is an attorney that works in regulating cannabis products, and she said Texas laws are hopelessly outdated.
Texas is so far behind on regulating cannabis. And when the state gets behind the market, this is what you see, a very messy market.
But Hayes said there are many people who use these products for medical benefits because the Texas Compassionate Use Program doesn't work.
You also are hearing from a lot of people here about the enormous medical demand for cannabis products. They work for a lot of people, but we have kept the TCUP program so strangled, people can't get in it, or they can't access the products, or the products are way too expensive because they're over-regulated.
Dr. Matthew Rosheim at the University of North Texas Health Science Center at Fort Worth School of Public Health has written multiple papers on derived intoxicating cannabis products. He told the senators these products are being marketed directly to children.
They are candy, cookies, chocolates, chips, and flavored vape products, and it's entirely up to the retailers whether they decide to sell them to children. And they're getting in the hands of kids, as you've seen by the spikes in poison control calls, emergency department visits. And in 2023, 65 students in Tyler Independent School District alone were caught with THC vapes during that academic school year.
He says it's impossible to know right now all the negative health effects for children using THC. And it's impossible to regulate because the industry stays one step ahead of the laws.
What makes it even harder to regulate is that these products are being innovated specifically to circumvent any and all regulations. So it's not just Delta 8 and Delta 9, that's the tip of the iceberg now. We've identified over 26 different intoxicating compounds being marketed. There's Delta 10, THCA, THCO, THCP, HHC, and dozens others.
Rosheim said the solution is a comprehensive ban on all cannabis-derived intoxicating products. As the drought continues in South Texas, the political rhetoric about Mexico's water debt is heating up. Recently, the 9-member Rio Grande Valley legislative delegation sent a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken to express its deep concern over Mexico's missing water deliveries to the United States. The water situation in the Rio Grande Valley is getting dire. It's one of the richest farming areas of Texas. The climate allows for raising crops year-round, but with less water available to irrigate, the agriculture industry there is drying up, and the leaders are pointing their fingers of blame at Mexico for not complying with an 80-year-old treaty governing use of water in the Rio Grande. Martha Piskowski is a staff reporter for Inside Climate News and is covering the story.
So under the 1944 water treaty between the U.S. and Mexico, Mexico has to send a certain amount of water to the U.S. on the Rio Grande in a five-year cycle. And then the other part of the treaty is on the Colorado River. The U.S. sends Mexico water. So we're in year four of the cycle, and Mexico has only sent about 1 year's worth of water. So they're technically not yet in violation of the treaty, but it's going to be really hard for them to hit that target by next year.
Mexico is in a severe water crisis. Mexico City is expected to run out of water by the end of June. Northern Mexico around Monterrey, they've been in a water scarcity situation for a while. Does Mexico have water to spare to provide to comply with this treaty?
At this moment, the reservoirs in Chihuahua, where they could release water to flow down to the Rio Grande, the levels are pretty low. You know, what the farmers and politicians in Texas would say, you know, they've had 4 years, so there were previous points when there was more water. But right now, yeah, there's a lot of scarcity on both sides.
What are we seeing in the Rio Grande Valley, which there's a lot of agriculture there? How is this water situation impacting that?
The big headline earlier this year was in February when the last sugar mill in the Rio Grande Valley shut down. So this irregular water situation on the Rio Grande has made it just too difficult for farmers to plant sugar cane. You know, I spoke to some irrigation districts, and they're concerned about the citrus industry as well. So there's, you know, the Congress people from the Rio Grande Valley have been pushing this issue, but this summer is going to be quite difficult.
The way the situation has been framed from people like Senators Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, Mexico owes us water, and now our sugarcane processing facility is shut down. Are these things actually linked? If Mexico was giving us the water that they were supposed to, would we still have sugarcane in the Rio Grande Valley?
You know, there is a bigger picture question of what crops really are going to be sustainable long term. So, you know, part of the picture is what Mexico is sending, but also, you know, increasing temperature, changes in rainfall, those all play a role. So I think it is a bit unfair to pin this all on Mexico, and there needs to be those broader discussions of what a sustainable agricultural sector looks like with climate change and all of the environmental issues right now.
Yeah, because it does seem like we have these politicians who don't want to talk about climate change and sustainability, the fact that it's getting hotter and drier. These droughts are longer and more intense. But they do want to point the finger to Mexico as if the lack of water in the Rio Grande is because of their inability to pay the water debt. And Mexico has its own water problems.
Yeah, and if you look back to 1944 when the treaty was signed, in the 80 years since then, irrigation agriculture has really grown a lot in both countries. So there's just demands on the river that in the long term, we might not have the water that we've been able to count on. So, you know, Mexico can kind of be a political scapegoat for this, but there's also, you know, things that need to be done within Texas to address these challenges.
There's a lot of talk about how important this treaty is, this international water boundary treaty with Mexico, and that the treaty needs to be maintained. But you write about the buoys that Greg Abbott put in the Rio Grande and how that's a violation of the treaty. I mean, how does that fit together?
So last summer, as the situation with the water deliveries was already rising up again, you know, we see Texas place buoys in the river ostensibly to deter migrants from crossing. And this is all kind of in the same, this is viewed in the same picture as the water treaty. I actually got, was able to obtain emails that said that officials from Mexico postponed a meeting over the water treaty because they were so upset about the buoys. So, you know, one action on immigration that might seem separate from the water issue could kind of set off these tensions between the two countries. So those two issues kind of can be at odds.
So what happens if Mexico does not pay this water debt?
There's not anything specifically written into the treaty of what the consequences are. There is a provision that in circumstances of extraordinary drought, the five-year cycle can roll over into the next five-year cycle. Texas politicians really don't want Mexico to rely on that option. They've done it in the past. It's really unclear what will happen if we get to October 2025, which is, and Mexico still hasn't hit that target. You know, the U.S. is still hoping for some sort of diplomatic answer to this, but time is ticking.
Martha Piskowski is a staff reporter for Inside Climate News. While parts of Texas remain in drought, other areas are being hammered with severe storms, high winds, and tornadoes. In North Texas, communities caught in the path of last week's devastating tornadoes are beginning to assess the damage and recover. Deadly storms ripped through North Texas last weekend, killing at least 7 people and injuring about 100 others. The small town of Valley View, near the Oklahoma border, was hit especially hard. KERA's Elizabeth Mayung reports on how residents are dealing with the aftermath.
It's the morning after a tornado swept through Cook County, but Valley View United Methodist Church is still having Sunday service. Pastor Beata Hall preaches to a handful of congregants who stepped away from organizing food and clothing donations. She says she's already given a sermon on expecting the unexpected.
But I'm going to say that that still holds very true. You never know what's going to happen next in Valley View.
The sermon feels particularly timely given how much was lost overnight. Speaking on Monday, Sammy Ponce says he's grateful that he and his family weren't at home when the tornado hit. But when he returned the following morning, he found his home completely destroyed. He salvaged anything he could, clothing, pictures, valuables, but some things can't be replaced.
The most important thing that was going through my mind was that, you know, all the memories that were here that were just gone in a few seconds.
Governor Greg Abbott says more than 200 homes and structures were destroyed in the storms that rolled across several North Texas counties, including Denton, Collin, and Montague. Many people were caught off guard when the storms hit. Valley View residents say tornado sirens didn't go off, leaving some to scramble. The destruction extended down I-35, where a Shell station became a pile of scrap metal and debris. On Sunday afternoon, construction crews combed through the rubble. While the area has been hard hit, residents are coming together to help. A steady stream of diapers, backpacks, food, and water came into the community center on Sunday. That's where Mayor Pro Tem Joe Wilkerson was helping manage recovery efforts.
Community's really stepped up, and they're bringing everything imaginable, so we're doing good. Just going to have to start getting it out towards people.
Down the road at the Baptist Church's Reach Out Center, the Red Cross set up a shelter where survivors can sleep and get a hot shower. Tana Conk is the disaster program manager of the Red Cross in Fort Worth. She says about 35 people stayed at the shelter Saturday night, including 9 family members and some travelers who got caught in the storm.
We fed them breakfast and we, you know, tended their needs. And, you know, they've started finding their own ways to get back home or get on towards their vacation that they were planning.
Pastor Beata Hall says residents are still coming to terms with the damage left behind by this weekend's storms.
Every kid was cheered for loudly at graduation, and it feels like such a dichotomy to have that happen 2 weeks ago and then have this here, where there is such destruction and devastation.
She says she'll help her community through the grieving process. It hits everyone differently.
The ultimate hope is that they come to that next stage where there is hope, where there is still joy, where there is still a promise of new things. But I also don't think anybody's going to be there anytime soon. And that will be okay.
Hall says most of the short-term needs have been met, but true recovery will be a long road ahead for the close-knit community. For KERA News, I'm Elizabeth Myong in Dallas.
Earlier this year, the military began implementing a new system to deal with sexual harassment and abuse cases. Those cases are now being investigated by an independent panel rather than by the alleged victims' commanders. Advocates say they're already seeing the effects, though some say service members are still afraid of retaliation and they lack trust in the process. Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Acorta-Solorio reports.
Patricia Olivares moved to Killeen, Texas in 2020 to manage the political campaign of a state House candidate, but she didn't expect to find herself intertwined with the case of a missing soldier.
One of the things that you're taught as you're going through campaign school is, you know, you have to learn the lay of the land. And the best way to do that is to pick up a couple of local newspapers and just read through them. And the first thing that I see on the front page is a picture of Specialist Gein, and the headline is Fort Hood Soldier Missing.
At that point, Specialist Vanessa Gein had been missing for 2 weeks from Fort Hood, the Army base now known as Fort Cavazos. Olivares said she'll never forget the words of conviction from Vanessa's mother, Gloria.
One of the last things that Gloria said to me as we finished our meeting, she goes, "Yo les di a mi hija viva y a mí me la van a entregar viva. I gave them my daughter alive, and they're going to give me my daughter back alive."
Before Gein went missing, she had told her mother she was being sexually harassed by a fellow soldier, but was afraid to report it to her commanders. Officials later discovered her remains. Suspect Aaron Robinson, also a soldier, shot himself when confronted by Killeen police. Following Gein's death, Congress passed a law that takes sexual harassment cases out of the hands of military commanders. Instead, they're investigated by independent panels. Olivares now works with the Service Women's Action Network, which advocates for military and sexual assault victims.
That is something big, you know, to be able to make that shift, that culture shift in the military is a very big deal.
Supporters of the change hope that victims will feel less reluctant to report assaults and less fearful they'll face retaliation from their commanders. Stephanie Gattas is the CEO of the Pink Berets, an advocacy group for women in the military. She says there has been a rise in assault reports since the law took effect.
Now, we are still seeing an increase across the board, and we don't know if it's because more women and men are coming forward and reporting, or could it be that we still haven't rectified the situation?
But she says even with the change, some soldiers remain reluctant to report. Under the new law, when the independent panel begins an investigation, the service member's chain of command is still informed. And although commanders no longer have the power to stop the investigation, there's still a concern about what could happen to the person who filed the complaint.
There's a chance that you'll be retaliated against and ostracized by your fellow service members. So getting at that cultural piece of victim blaming is really important.
Josh Connolly is Senior Vice President for Protect Our Defenders. As the Chief of Staff for former Congresswoman Jackie Speier, he advocated for this and other reforms for the past 15 years.
We need to keep focusing on that and keep collecting data on how many instances of retaliation there are.
He cites a success story from the new law, a case involving a staff sergeant who retired in 2017, but was recently called back to active duty so the new Office of Special Trial Counsel could prosecute him.
We're calling the individual back to active service is not usually a normal thing that takes place. So it's interesting and clearly a victory for this new office.
The staff sergeant pleaded guilty in May to 5 counts of sexual assault. Gattas says that kind of prosecution can go a long way to make service members feel more comfortable reporting sexual harassment and abuse.
It has driven more women to use their voice. And I think that we're seeing the landscape change in terms of people who are now fighting for change.
Gattas says the passing of the act was a beacon of hope for women in the service. I'm Gabriela Alcorta-Solorio in San Antonio.
The story was produced by the American Homefront Project a public media collaboration that reports on military life and veterans. It's been 2 years since the shooting at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, and in that time, the parents of the shooting victims have tried and failed to get the Texas legislature to raise the age to buy assault weapons. KRA's Carolina Love reports they are preparing for the next legislative session, where they will try again.
The National Rifle Association's leadership forum in Dallas was standing room only. Several attendees wore red MAGA hats as they eagerly awaited to hear from former President Donald Trump. The presumed Republican nominee urged gun owners to turn out and vote for him if they want to keep their firearms.
And let there be no doubt, the survival of our Second Amendment is very much on the ballot.
Texas is known for its loose gun restrictions. Governor Greg Abbott also touted his pro-Second Amendment record at the NRA convention.
Since I became governor, Texas has passed more significant Second Amendment protections than any other state in the United States of America.
That includes permitless carry, which allows most Texans who are at least 21 years old to legally carry a handgun without a permit. Texas also has a law that makes it a Second Amendment sanctuary state. The law makes it harder to enforce new federal gun regulations. Representative Justin Holland co-wrote the bill that became the Second Amendment sanctuary state law. He's also one of the Republicans that voted in favor of a bill that would have raised the age to purchase semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21. Holland's vote was a surprise. He helped flip the vote in favor of the bill. The proposed gun law made it out of committee, but it failed to pass after it didn't move any further in the Texas House. Veronica Mata says the fact the bill made it out of committee is a sign of progress. Mata's daughter, Tess, was one of the 19 children that were killed alongside two teachers at the Robb Elementary School shooting in Uvalde 2 years ago.
It was also a step in the right direction, letting us know that there are people that are listening to us. We were able to turn to Republicans to vote on it.
Holland has faced backlash for his vote for the Raise the Age bill. The Rockwall County GOP condemned his vote on social media ahead of his primary race. The Post said he went against Republican priorities. Holland says that's a common accusation in the Republican Party.
You're told what kind of Republican that you are by the way that you vote on certain things, and if you don't do everything the way that certain group or certain party says, then, you know, you're a Republican in name only.
Holland says most of the people he talked to in his district were in favor of raising the age to buy assault rifles. It's a sentiment many Texas voters share. A University of Texas at Austin poll found that 73% of Texas voters, including 63% of Republicans, support raising the legal age to purchase any firearm to 21. Shannon Flores is a Texan and a gun owner who advocates for firearm safety with the Giffords Law Center. She says most gun owners support firearm safety regulations, even in Texas. Flores says gun lobbies like the NRA block those laws.
It's been well documented that the NRA is a big funder and can influence votes.
The NRA's Political Action Committee has donated thousands of dollars to Texas Republican campaigns, including to Abbott's campaign fund. But the gun rights group's influence has waned, and advocates for gun reform see that as an opportunity. And for Kimberly Mata Rubio, it could mean a lasting legacy for her daughter Lexi, who was killed during the Uvalde shooting.
I want her name attached to change, not just how she died, but all of the change that's coming after.
When or if that change will happen remains to be seen. But Mata Rubio says she'll never stop fighting for her daughter's legacy. I'm Caroline Love in Dallas.
The students and staff at 13 San Antonio ISD campuses said their final goodbyes this week. The schools impacted by the district's right-sizing plan closed their doors for good on the last day of the school year. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips attended the grand finale ceremony for Dory Miller Elementary on San Antonio's east side.
Current and former students, parents, teachers, and principals gathered at Dory Miller Elementary to hear speeches and walk the halls of the school for the last time. Alicia Herrera was one of many in the crowd who alternated between cheers and tears during the ceremony. Her daughter Jenna has been at Miller since kindergarten and would have been back for fifth grade next year if the elementary school wasn't closing its doors.
I'm sad, but it's a new beginning and she's looking forward to it.
Herrera says Miller is a tight-knit community with compassionate, hands-on teachers. She says she decided to send her daughter to the district's recommended school, Smith Elementary, because that's where Jenna's special education teacher, Tondra Williams, will be.
That was the only reason why I agreed to her going to Smith. Wherever she goes, that's where Jenna's going.
While we're talking, Williams walks up and gives Jenna a hug.
This is my girl, my dance partner. Yep.
Williams has taught at Miller Elementary for 20 years.
I've been here my whole teaching career. It's just a piece of my heart is here. So I'm very sad. I'm very sad.
She says saying goodbye is hard.
But like I said, the heart of Miller is not the school building. It's the people who come and gone. And we're going to be all scattered. But I think we have a legacy that we will carry with us anywhere we go.
Tondra Williams' 25-year-old son, Dominic Williams, attended Dory Miller Elementary when he was a kid. He says the murals of the school's namesake made a strong impression on him.
It's a black guy doing something heroic. I said when I was younger, you don't see or hear too much about that.
He remembers lining up outside the library after PE and soaking up the details in his favorite mural, which shows Dory Miller shooting down Japanese planes during the attack on Pearl Harbor.
You know, it shows me that I could be strong. I can hold my head up high. And especially as an African-American man, I see that, you know, he did something special and, you know, people recognize him for that.
Dory Miller was the first Black American awarded a Navy Cross. He was born in Waco, Texas. According to district records, Dory Miller Elementary started out as a two-room school for Black children in San Antonio's Lincolnshire neighborhood when schools were segregated. When it opened in 1947, the PTA voted to name it after the war hero.
The point is that they have heroes.
Curtis Brazil painted the murals of Dory Miller in the school about 15 years ago.
African-American heroes and all sorts of heroes that they can be proud of in the military, out of the military, and in various walks of life that they can look up to and that they can study about.
Brazil also used to teach art lessons to the students.
So he used to come in after school, help out after school program and, you know, do painting classes with us.
Dominic Williams says after seeing the crowd at the ceremony, he knows the school will be remembered for a long time, but he's worried the school's namesake will be forgotten.
I thought the school would make it forever past my lifetime for sure, but it's not. And I just hope that what comes next is going to help out teachers, you know, around SAISD as well.
Dory Miller's assistant principal will be at MLK Academy next year. The interim principal doesn't know yet where she'll be working. Plans for how to use the buildings left empty from right-sizing haven't been decided yet. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.